version of the first set of lecture notes, which is an improvement, in my opinion. And then there's a new version of Lecture 7, which is a big improvement, in my opinion. And it's also worth looking up the new version of Lecture 7 because the problem set is going to be about partially about driving some of the results in there. And I'm still tweaking the problem set, but it'll be sent out this afternoon. Yeah, I guess besides that, so there's a guy and forget about that. A big part of the village goes out on a hunting expedition, and they're all out hunting for a deer, and they come upon an old man from the village who they know who's hunting by himself, and his eyesight is not good, and they say, we're not deer, don't shoot. And he says, aha, all my life, and finally talking deer. Anyway. Okay. It's very unpredictable. To my mind, I don't know. I think my sense of humor has gotten twisted by these jokes themselves, and I seem completely out of sync with you guys about which ones I think are going to be funny, but oh well. Anyway, I'm what can I say? I'm just okay. So last time we met George Gamov, he did two awesome tricks. He's going to do one more trick right before your eyes right now. Another little bit of very elementary algebraic conjuring. Just for fun, we saw how Gamov concluded that the DNA the DNA code was in triplet code. Then how he concluded that it was likely the case that the abundances of the lightest elements in the periodic table were not cooked up in stars or in supernovae, but rather in the first few seconds after the Big Bang. And now we want to see how he realized that there would be a cosmic microwave background radiation permeating the universe, and how he would have estimated what its temperature would be today, or what redshift it was produced at, what moment in cosmic history it was produced at. Hey, that's something I never defined. This belongs in like one of the first lectures, but it just occurs to me that I never said it. So it is conventional. So you can label a moment in cosmic history by the time that it happened at. You can label it as the time, there's so some event happened, you can label it by its cosmic time. In other words, if you're a co-moving observer, how much has your clock ticked since the Big Bang until that event happened? Or we said you could label it by its conformal time. T cosmic is just what we've normally been calling T. Or there's the look back time, how far in the past was it relative to today? There's various ways to label at what point it happened, but a very common one that you will hear is you'll talk about an epoch occurring at a certain redshift, and all that means is that if the universe was smaller than today, if the universe today is larger than the universe at some earlier time, if the scale factor is larger, the ratio by which it is larger labels this time. That's equivalent to what time it occurred at, as long as A has been increasing monotonically over the course of cosmic history. And this ratio is often referred to as 1 plus z, where z is called the redshift. And that is just because if you release a photon, let's say that some hydrogen gas emits some hydrogen lines, some of the characteristic spectral lines of hydrogen, at this moment, again, the effect of the expansion of the universe is that their wavelength expands. It's the original emitted wavelength, you know, each of those lines had was originally located at some wavelength, but then that all gets expanded, or in other words, the frequency we saw goes down as 1 upon a from whatever frequency it was emitted at. And so shifted things that are shifted towards higher wavelengths or lower frequencies are quote-unquote red-shifted, because red is at the low-frequency end of the visible spectrum. It's just a colloquialism. The difference from unity, the difference between you know what I mean. Z is called the redshift. Sometimes when people are being loose, they'll call 1 plus Z the redshift. And of course, when Z is large, the difference between 1 plus Z and Z is negligibly small, so you don't need to really worry about the distinction. But for example, if I say I just observed a galaxy at redshift 1, that means I observed a galaxy when the scale factor was 1/2 of its current value. Okay, or if I observe a galaxy at redshift 7, that means I'm seeing it when the scale factor was 1/8 of its current value. Okay, or the volume was 1/8 cubed. Okay, sorry, that was a diversion. But I won't erase it. I will erase it. I won't erase it. So we want to calculate, we want to see why the CMB is there, what it is, and at what temperature it took place, as Gamov would have done it. Okay, so Gamov is proceeding on now from his previous calculation. He previously had been thinking about the epoch of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and that all took place when the temperature was 1 MeV. So that's, you know, that's not so different from the temperature at the center of the sun. That's sort of nuclear scale. That's the temperature corresponding to nuclear physics energy scales. These are like the various transitions between different nuclear isotopes and nuclear excited states. Then we cool down. One thing to say is that, you know, part of what he was thinking about was the most interesting things in cosmic history, the most interesting events, the events that leave relics that you can observe today, are moments where either departures from equilibrium occur, or for some other reason, some dramatic change occurs. And so we're just trying to sort of think through cosmic history and find when such epochs might occur, and think about what the consequences would be. So after Big Bang nucleosynthesis, we have some hydrogen atoms, some helium atoms, but they're mostly still ionized. Okay, the temperature is the binding energy for hydrogen and helium is of order 10 eV. And so when you have something that's when you have you know, electrons that are only bound to their atoms with this sort of strength, but they're being bombarded by photons with much higher temperature than this, 1 MeV is 10 to the 6 eV. You know, they're essentially all going to be ionized. All of the electrons will be stripped off of their atoms. And so really, we don't have these two atoms, neutral atoms. We have, you know, their nuclei, and then all their electrons are running around separated from the atoms. And so it's natural to ask, at what point will the universe cool enough for, well, let's forget about, again, hydrogen is most of the universe, 75% of the universe by mass, and even a larger percentage by number. So let's just, so there is helium recombination, but let's forget about that. Well, let's think about when it will be that the universe will be cool enough that the electrons and protons will want to combine together to form neutral hydrogen atoms. And then what will happen then? Okay, so let's first estimate the temperature at which that'll happen. So the reaction that keeps these various, the reaction that we're talking about that takes you between between ionized and non-ionized hydrogen is electron plus proton going back and forth to neutral hydrogen atom plus photon. Now I'm going to just quote a result from statistical mechanics that you that you hopefully have seen before, and I'm not which I'm not going to derive right now in the spirit of doing this quick and dirty. But so just as if you bring in statistical mechanics, you know, one of the things you derive in a thermodynamics or stat mech class is that you when you take two systems and you let them come into contact with one another and exchange energy, when will they stop exchanging energy? When will they decide that they've passed enough energy back and forth? The answer is when their temperatures have become equal to one another. And similarly, if you take two, or you take several systems and you allow them to exchange particles, number of particles, destroy some particles from one system and transfer those particles, make more particles in another system, you know, by reactions like this. So this is a reaction that, you know, in this direction, destroys one proton, destroys one electron, while creating one hydrogen atom and creating one photon. When does that process decide that it's had enough and there's no more net transfer in one direction or another? The answer is that, so just as this is thermal equilibrium, this situation is called chemical equilibrium when this reaction has decided it is fulfilled. It doesn't need any net transfer back and forth in one direction or the other. And that is when the chemical potentials, so for this particular reaction, you know, that is when the chemical potentials on one side add to equal the chemical potentials on the other side. So first of all, another process that is in equilibrium at this time, chemical equilibrium at this time, is just, you know, you can just create photons, and a photon is its own antiparticle. There's no, you know, with an electron, you can't create an electron out of nowhere without creating also an anti-electron, for example, because there are various conservation laws of charge and lepton number that you have to satisfy, fermion number. But with nothing like that with photons. You can have a reaction like this where an electron comes in, an electron plus a photon comes out. So if this process is in chemical equilibrium, you know, the analogous equation is this, which says that chemical potential of the photon is equal to zero. Okay, so let's forget this. So anyway, that's one equation we need. And now let's just consider the following ratio. Consider, as the universe cools down, the ratio of the number density of electrons times the number density of, so this is free electrons, electrons that are not bound up in hydrogen atoms, and protons that are not bound up in hydrogen atoms, divided by the number density of neutral hydrogen atoms. Let's think about energies. We're going down to energies where, you know, the temperature is not too much bigger than this. So that you know, we have a hope of these things binding. So in that regime, all of these electrons, protons, and hydrogen atoms are all non-relativistic. They're all, you know, even an electron has a temperature of has a mass of 500 kilo electron volts, which is much higher than this energy. So we use our, remember we have derived our expression for the abundance of a species in thermal equilibrium when it's non-relativistic. That expression was like this. So if we plug the corresponding expressions in for any NP and NH. Well, so the prefactors, let's first of all talk about the prefactors. We have an MET over 2 pi to the 3 halves, an M proton T over 2 pi to the 3 halves, and then from 1 over N sub H, we have 2 pi over M hydrogen T to the 3 halves. Okay, but so first of all, the mass of a proton is almost exactly equal to the mass of a hydrogen atom. So at our George Gamow level of analysis, these two things cancel very precisely to one. So So now let's do the exponential factors. We'll get minus me plus mp minus mh, that quantity from the three factors contributing that guy. And then we'll get plus mu e plus mu p minus mu h. Okay, but so this quantity precisely cancels because of this chemical equilibrium condition. That's why we chose I chose to look at this particular ratio precisely because I wanted the chemical potentials to drop out. I just didn't want to worry about the chemical potentials. Simplify life. And then this, the mass of an electron plus the mass of a proton minus the mass of a hydrogen atom, I mean, that's just a hydrogen atom weighs a little bit less than its constituent parts because it has some binding energy. The binding energy of, you know, this is nothing but the binding energy, the definition of the binding energy of hydrogen. And it's a famous number. It's 13.6 eV, the Rydberg constant. Okay, so this, let's call that binding energy of hydrogen. Okay, so minus E sub H over T. Okay, and now we're almost there. Let's just define the ionization fraction to be, okay, there's two possible places for an electron to be. It can either be free, in which case it's counted by N sub E, or it can be in a hydrogen atom, in which case it's counted by N sub H. So the fraction that is ionized, the fraction of electrons that are free, is just this, and then the corresponding thing for the non-ionized fraction is then just 1 minus the ionized fraction. Okay, so we can just, you know, multiply and divide by factors of n sub e plus n sub h here to rewrite. Basically, if we divide both sides by two factors of n sub e plus n sub h, and multiply both sides by one factor of n sub e plus n sub h, in other words, divide by one factor in total, the left-hand side of that equation becomes x sub e squared. Oh, I should have said. So the universe is charge neutral. So the number of ionized electrons at any given time is equal to the number of ionized protons at any given time. So this is really n e squared over NH. Okay, so again, I'm just saying if I now add the appropriate number of denominators to convert the top two factors into XEs and the bottom factor into a 1 minus XE, I get XE squared 1 minus XE on the left-hand side, and then on this side I have just this one extra factor times what I already had there. This factor and this exponential. Okay, and now let me take this guy and just massage a little bit. So again, by charge neutrality, the number of electrons is equal to the number of protons. So this is the number of protons plus the number of hydrogen atoms. In other words, it's the total number of baryons bound up in hydrogen atoms. And we said last time that is 3/4 of the baryons in the universe. So this is 3/4 the number density of baryons. And then last time the number density of baryons divided by the number density of photons is the so-called photon to baryon ratio. That's this thing that has been roughly 10 to the minus 9, 1 billionth, ever since the protons and antiprotons annihilated. That's commonly called eta, which is a bit confusing because conformal time is also called eta. But so if I just multiply and divide by the number density of photons, I can rewrite that as 3/4 eta number density of photons. And then the number density of photons, I can write as my relativistic expression for the number density of a relativistic species, which, if I remember correctly, is, what is it exactly? For a bosonic species, yeah, it's zeta of 3 over pi squared. Okay, and then that's for each relativistic species. For a photon, there's really two different species. There's because it has two polarizations. Okay. So I just plug that expression in there, simplify a little bit on the right-hand side, and the right-hand side just becomes okay, and so again, the idea here is that Xe, the ionized fraction, the fraction of electrons that are ionized from their hydrogen atoms, as at early times when the universe is hot, Xe is going to be equal to unity, and at late times when the universe is sufficiently cold, Xe is basically going to want to drop to zero. So as time progresses, or as the scale factor expands, there's going to be some moment where the electrons want to jump back on their atoms, and let's just try to identify that moment. We'll define that moment to be the moment to be the midpoint where Xe is equal to 1/2. So if we plug in Xe equals 1/2 on this side of the equation, this whole side of the equation just becomes 1/2. And then over here, well, the mass of the electron is known. That's 500 kiloelectron volts. The binding energy of hydrogen is known. That's 13.6 eV. The photon to baryon, the baryon to photon ratio, the number of baryons per photon in the universe, is known. That's 10 to the minus 9. The thing that's unknown here is the ratio B sub H over T, which appears here and here. So you can't solve this equation analytically, but you can just ask Mathematica what the solution is. And the answer is that BH over T is, well, if you let me just convert it directly to so BH over T is some dimensionless number that I actually don't remember. It's like, I guess it's like 39. It's like 40. Okay, when you solve this equation with all the numbers plugged in, you'll get that this thing is equal to 40, which amounts to saying, since this is 13.6 eV, that the temperature at which this transition happens is 0.3 eV. Or in other words, about 3,300 Kelvin. Whereas today, we observe a cosmic microwave background radiation of 3 Kelvin. Okay, and so what I want to explain is that even though, after this moment, the photons are no longer bouncing around in thermal equilibrium, suddenly they have nothing. After this moment, before this moment, they had all these wonderful electrons to bump into. A photon loves to bump into an electron, but it does not love to bump into neutral things like hydrogen atoms. So suddenly, it had all these things to bump into. It was like a happy little pinball in a pinball machine. And then somehow it just flew out the side of the pinball machine and has just had nothing to bump into for the rest of the age of the universe. So just every photon that used to be bumping around, suddenly after this transition moment, 90% of them never bumped into anything again. They just went streaming along geodesics across the universe. And the thing that I will explain in a moment is that just as the photons have a black body spectrum, a thermal equilibrium spectrum with a temperature that scales as 1 over A, just as we've seen that when they're in thermal equilibrium. It turns out that, furthermore, once they're out of thermal equilibrium, and just if you just take a black body spectrum and now let all the photons just free stream according to the geodesic equation, their temperature still scales like this. The whole spectrum just gets redshifted in time, gets stretched in time, as if the temperature was still going down as 1 over A. So the fact that we observe a black body spectrum at 3 Kelvin today, and predict by this argument that it was produced with a temperature of 3300 Kelvin is telling us that it was produced, that this transition took place, that this transition is called recombination, by the way. Recombination took place when the scale factor was smaller than today. So today's scale factor is bigger than the scale factor at recombination was, by a factor of 3300 Kelvin over 3 Kelvin, or in other words, 1100. And you'll also hear people say this is the redshift of recombination, 1 over z recombination. Okay. And so I think originally,
why is it called recombination? Shouldn't it just be combination?
Yeah, that makes no sense. It should just be called combination. That's a good point. So for some reason, people say electrons and protons recombined into hydrogen at this moment, as if they had somehow also previously been combined into hydrogen at some earlier epoch. Whereas in fact, there's no reason to think that they ever were. So that's true. I don't know what the history of that is, but it's too. I'm not big enough to change that. I can't. Some you got to choose your battles, and this can't be undone. Okay. So now let's go back. So Gamow did a calculation like this. It was actually, I think, in the same paper. You know, he was just kind of going through and trying to spot these various important transitions that would take place, and calculate roughly the temperatures and the consequences. And yeah, he realized this point that, so this was in the mid 40s, that there were all these photons hanging around, a very hot bath of photons, which would have a perfectly thermal spectrum because they were in beautiful thermal equilibrium. And then rather suddenly, they would have nothing to bump into anymore and just go shooting off across the universe. As I will explain in one moment, they maintain their thermal spectrum. And so the prediction is you should see a bath of photons just uniformly distributed across the night sky, you know, in every direction on the night sky, just a uniform bath of photons with a perfectly thermal, perfectly black body or Planck spectrum, as if they were emitted from something in perfect thermal equilibrium, but with some temperature well below 3300 Kelvin, because the universe has expanded by some large factor since it was dense enough to do this sort of thing. And in fact, now here it's maybe good. Well, anyway, so he even made a rough estimate of what the temperature was, which is not too bad, not too far off. But let's leave that aside. I keep forgetting. So why does the black body spectrum continue to redshift as 1 upon A, even when thermal equilibrium is lost and all of the photons are no longer banging into anything and just streaming across the universe? You know, if you just think about the black body spectrum for a photon, the Planck distribution function is 1 over... I mean, the Bose-Einstein distribution function is 1 over E minus mu over T minus 1. But for a photon, we saw mu, its chemical potential, is equal to 0. And then the energy of a photon is just equal to its momentum. And then we've seen what happens to every that a particle with spatial momentum p. This is the magnitude p of its spatial momentum. That just redshifts as 1 upon a. So if I correspondingly redshift t by 1 upon a, I mean there's a common factor by which every momentum is just being redshifted by a common factor of a as the universe expands. That's what we learned from studying the geodesic equation several lectures ago. So you can just absorb all of that into a common rescaling of the temperature t by 1 over a. And it'll look like this form is preserved. It'll look like the perfect blackbody form is preserved. So anyway, suffice it to say that for whatever reason, no one paid attention to this. But then in 1965, two guys at Bell Labs were building better and better radio telescopes, and they were trying to test the sensitivity of the radio telescope, and they found there was some noise they couldn't get rid of, and famously they originally thought it was pigeon crap, and then they discovered it was, since then Jim Peebles told them it was actually the cosmic microwave background, and they got a Nobel Prize, and modern cosmology was born, and suddenly all of this stuff became a lot more serious. But another thing I should say, so in 1992, there was sort of the first dedicated satellite mission to measure the cosmic microwave background. And so one of the things that they did was measure the spectrum, just how many cosmic microwave background photons did they detect as a function of frequency. And there's the predicted form, the blackbody form, the Planck spectrum, you know, has some shape. And I don't know if any of you have ever seen this figure. If you ever see cosmology talk, sometimes you'll see this figure shown. There was this FIRAS instrument, and you know it took data points, and the measured data points fit a blackbody spectrum with 2.73 Kelvin, and you know they fit it perfectly, and to show you know the error bars are so small that they blow them up by a factor of 10,000 or something, so that you can see the error bars on the figure. It's incredibly precise black body. It's like the more precise than any black body spectrum that you can create in a lab on Earth. And then the other thing that COBE did, but that has been really a big story since there, that subsequent experiments have done a better and better job of, is measure the so-called anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. So in other words, now you look up at the sky, and in each direction, you point at this direction on the sky, schematically speaking, and you stare. You don't collect photons from all over. You only collect the photons coming from exactly that direction. And when you do that, you find, again, you get a perfect blackbody spectrum, but the temperature is not the same in every direction. It's almost the same. It's the same to one part in 100,000. But to one part in 100,000, you if you point in this direction, and you point in this direction, you get perfect blackbody spectrums, but with slightly different temperatures. In other words, their peak lies at a slightly different frequency to roughly one part in 100,000. Okay, and that is reflecting the fact that so what you're measuring there are the most pristine. You're doing the most pristine measurement possible of the fact that the universe, although it was extremely well approximated to, with an accuracy of one part in 100,000, it was extremely well approximated by a perfectly homogeneous, isotropic, Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe in the early universe, the maximally symmetric spatial slices that we began this course by studying. There are these tiny ripples on top of that homogeneity, and so you have little patches of space that were a little denser and a little hotter than everywhere else by a part in 10 to the 5, and other patches that were a little colder than everywhere else by a part in 10 to the 5. And you know that sounds just like a detail, but that's everything. That's why you and I are here. You know that so that even though this is just a slight overdensity in the early universe, given enough time, this this this, if you have some matter here, this gives the matter, you know, if it was perfectly homogeneous, a little pile of matter here would have no preference about which way to fall. But in fact, in the presence of these homogeneities, it prefers to fall towards the slightly larger gravitational field over here and away from the slightly smaller gravitational field over here. And so it falls in, and now that just makes this plus a little bit bigger. That makes this overdensity even more overdense, and some of the matter over here that was near this guy, you know, really decides it would prefer to go over where this bigger gravitational field is, and so this region gets even more underdense, and so there's this instability that runs away. The regions that were initially just slightly overdense get more and more and more dense relative to the mean. Regions that were slightly underdense get less and less dense relative to the mean, and eventually these things become galaxies and people, and these things become voids and boring places. These are like the places that are really dead on the weekend. I was going to redraw. Now is a good time to redraw the picture that we drew last time. So yeah, you know, we're beginning here to get a slightly more nuanced picture of how the universe evolved than just the homogeneous evolution we were discussing in previous lectures. So I just want to run with that for a minute. Okay, so again, let me make this plot of, I'll plot energy density or log of energy density on this axis and scale factor or log of scale factor on this axis. And again, we have a component that is relativistic matter whose energy density scales as a to the minus 4. And then we have a component of non-relativistic matter whose energy density scales as a to the minus 3. And then today, apparently, we have this bothersome component that goes as a to the minus 0, known as dark energy. Okay, and so I think I said before that when the radiation energy dominates, that is not surprisingly called the radiation-dominated era. Hear people say that. And when the matter dominates, that's called the matter-dominated era. And when the dark energy dominates, that's called the dark energy-dominated era. And again, this is the epoch of matter radiation equality. It corresponds to matter radiation equality. So it corresponds to a redshift of, you know, a few thousand, let's say 3,500. So again, a redshift of 3,500 means that the scale factor was 3,500 times smaller. Everything was 3,500 times closer together when these guys crossed. And again, the CMB is only a rather short time after that in scale factor terms. It was when we just learned that, we just calculated that the CMB was released when at a redshift of about 1,000. So the scale factor had only changed by a few between matter radiation equality and the moment when the CMB was released. Whereas Big Bang nucleosynthesis, so the CMB happened in the matter-dominated era, but really just barely. Whereas the Big Bang nucleosynthesis happened deep in the radiation-dominated era, somewhere when the temperature was, this is a temperature of 10 eV, this is a temperature of 1 MeV, a million EV. So it's something like a redshift of a billion. Okay, so what happens? So the picture that appears to fit observations is that there was a spectrum of perturbations. There were random initial perturbations laid down, and we'll describe in more detail later and show how to describe that randomness and how the leading most popular, let's say, explanation for what generated that randomness quantitatively, namely inflation. But so for now, the point is there are these little fluctuations in the density, some over dense regions, some under dense regions. The characteristic sizes of the fluctuations are about one part in 100,000. And throughout much of the radiation-dominated era, if you calculate it in detail, almost nothing happens. This instability that I drew, where matter wants to fall into the regions that already have more matter and fall out of the regions that already have less matter. So this instability that wants to make the density perturbations grow as the universe evolves, okay, it is there, but it can only operate very slowly in this epoch. And then when you reach this epoch, suddenly it turns out that because the rate at which the scale factor changes, so during the radiation-dominated era, again, we have A, radiation scales as A to the minus 4, and during the matter-dominated era, we have the radiation scaling as A to the minus 3. So if you go to the Friedman equation, which says that H squared is proportional to rho, which is proportional to A to the minus 4. And this is A dot over A squared. Whereas in the radiation-dominated era, if you solve this equation, A dot over A squared is proportional to A to the minus 4. You integrate, you move all the A's onto one side of the equation, all the T's onto the other side of the equation, and integrate, you find that A is proportional to T to the 1/2 during this epoch. Whereas if you do the same exercise during the matter-dominated era, you find that A is proportional to T to the 2/3. So that turns out to make all the difference, how fast the universe manages to expand relative to how fast matter can. There's a competition, right? The universe is trying to make these regions expand apart from one another, and this gravitational instability is making certain regions want to contract together. And so the expansion rate and that tendency to clump are in competition with one another. And suddenly, when the universe becomes matter-dominated, the clumping really begins to win. The effect of the instability becomes strong. So what happens is that, well, there's something that we haven't mentioned yet, but that is a necessary ingredient in explaining various things about. Appears to be necessary to explain various cosmological observations, but in particular, appears to be necessary to explain the observations of the cosmic microwave background, and that is that you divide the non-relativistic matter into two parts. About 1/6 of the non-relativistic matter is the ordinary stuff of the periodic table. Normal matter that appears in the periodic table, so-called baryonic matter. So these are the so-called baryons. And something like the remaining 5/6 of the matter appears to be dark matter. Okay, which appears to not interact with photons. So we can't see it, and so that has an important consequence here, which is that we cross this threshold at which the universe becomes matter dominated, and we said what the matter at that point really wants to contract into gravitational clumps, and the dark matter can, and the dark matter goes ahead and does that. It quickly begins to form bigger and bigger and denser clumps that become the halos that appear to surround all sorts of different galaxies today. But the baryons, the normal atomic matter, basically hydrogen and helium, they can't do that yet because they're still ionized, and even stronger than the. More important than either the expansion of the universe or the gravitational instability, much more important than that is the fact that they are being bombarded by photons. They're all of these atoms are at this point still up until this, up until the CMB, up until the moment of recombination here, the gravitational instability can't operate on the baryons. They can't freely clump because they're being, the dominant thing that they're experiencing is just being slapped around by photons. Okay. So instead, what happens is that the dark matter clumps. You get these big wells where the baryons want to fall into. So here's a well with tons of dark matter, and the baryons, if it weren't for the photons, the baryons would just love to fall into this thing, and they try. They try to fall into this big gravitational potential well, but then they overdo it. They get too dense, and the photons, these are, again, in this period, they're ions falling in. They're surrounded by photons, and they're very tightly coupled to the photons. They're dragging the photons in. So they try to fall in, but then the photons get dragged in with them. Their pressure goes up like crazy and blows them back out. And so this oscillation sets in where baryonic matter wants to fall into the potential well, but it overshoots, then pressure drives it back out, but then it wants to fall back in. And so there's a period in between matter radiation equality and the release of the CMB, where the baryons and photons want to oscillate in and out of dark matter potential wells like this. And so this oscillation, now this is very, unfortunately due to time, this is, I just want to give the rough sketch of this oscillation has a predicted effect on the spectrum of fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So a prediction that has been, very well confirmed just within the last 15 years or 10 years. So it predicts some spectrum, and we'll describe in a minute what is being drawn here. With bumps and wiggles, and then now there are these data points that fit the predicted bumps and wiggles extremely well out to, well, there's really data across all of the bumps and wiggles that I've shown now. So what is being plotted here? So what we are not doing here is plotting the black body spectrum. I mean, this is a spectrum of number of photons as a function of frequency of those photons. Okay, this is something different. So here on the x-axis is L, the L that appears in spherical harmonics. So in other words, when you, so you do the following thing. You point your microwave telescope at each different direction on the sky. Okay, for every particular direction n hat, every particular direction on the night sky, you measure a temperature. Overall, that temperature is almost constant. It's almost 2.73 degrees Kelvin in any direction you look, but there's a small fluctuation. And that fluctuation does depend on which direction you look in. So this is about 10 to the minus 5 of this. So now let's take this fluctuating function on the sphere, this little thing that everywhere in every direction it's of order 10 to the minus 5 or minus 10 to the minus 5. But anyway, every function on it's just a number at every different point on the night sky. So you can take any function on a sphere and decompose it, into spherical harmonics, which you have probably met. For example, they appear in the wave function of the hydrogen atom as the angular dependence. So so remember, you can take any function on the sphere and decompose it into a sum from L equals 0 to infinity, and then a sum from M equals minus L to L of some coefficient, ALM, times the spherical harmonic, YLM, which is a function of angle. So these are, each of these is a function on the sphere, and then there, for every general function on the sphere, there's a unique decomposition with a you can translate that function into values of the coefficients of each of the different YLMs. So what is being plotted here basically is the mean squared value of ALM at a fixed M. So at a fixed L, I should say. So at a fixed value of L, there are M runs from minus L to L. So at a fixed value of L, there are 2L plus 1 different coefficients ALM that you measure when you decompose your map of the your measured value of the cosmic microwave background over the sphere. You take their mean squared value, so you take ALM absolute value squared for fixed L and summed over the 2L plus 1 this is the mean squared value of those ALMs averaged over all M at a fixed L. And that is what is being plotted basically here. So for every value of L, we have taken our map of the cosmic microwave background on the night sky, taken the mean squared value of ALM and plotted it here. These are sometimes called the CLs. And okay, so this is I've only been able to give the very roughest cartoon description of why there are these bumps and wiggles in the predicted spectrum as a consequence of this ringing oscillation that where baryons want to fall into dark matter wells, but photons want to drive them back out. But I just want to get across enough that you have some sense of what you're looking at when you see these famous pictures of the CMB. What you're seeing is this, that because of this acoustic oscillation effect in the early universe, where baryons want to fall in and out of dark matter wells, there is this predicted form with bumps and wiggles. And then you go out and measure the ALMs to estimate. And that's what the WMAP experiment did over the past decade, and that's what there's a new improved space satellite called the Planck experiment, which will be releasing its data in the beginning of next in January 2013. That'll give even much more accurate data and out to higher L. But anyway, it's a case where the error bars exquisitely match the predictions of a certain kind of model of the early universe, of the fluctuations in the early universe. Maybe that's all I want to say. We'll get to in more detail what the predicted primordial spectrum was that gave rise to this wiggly prediction, and how it is predicted to arise from inflation next week. I think that's all I wanted to say about that. Yeah. So, instead of embarking on dark matter, why don't I just, for once in my life, and more or less on time rather than running over? Or does that seem right? Or do you want to? Should we start on dark? Let's wait until next week for dark matter. Okay.